going to supply the kind it's supposed to for the standard that, you know, that it says it's for. So you may plug something into the USB port and go, oh, this thing doesn't work, but it may be the USB port that is not able to supply the current that is needed for that device. Does all that make sense now, Dick? K2RIW, KC2SHO.
I got a further question of what you're asking, John. It sounds to me like there is a kind of a USB analyzer. I presume it's a device you plug into the computer directly, and then the external USB device plugs into it. And now you've got this intermediate box which is giving you information about current, voltage, and whatever as a way of analyzing what's happening on your USB circuit. Is that what you're saying? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Yes, that is correct. And again, some have a variable load in them. I have one that actually has a knob. You can turn the load. So even you don't even need the other end of the device when you have that, just to see what kind of current it can supply. But yes, that's exactly right. I found it very educational. You can watch it go through its interrogation, if you will, of the source, saying, let's say I plug an iPhone into it. You can see it comes up at a few hundred milliamps, and then it jumps up to half an amp, and then maybe it goes to 1.5 amps, and then it tries for 2. Oh, can't supply 2. I'll go back to 1.5. Something like that. You know, I'm just drawing you a rough picture of what you can see, but it is interesting to watch these things happen. Also, to see if you're... if you have voltage drop across it, some USB ports I've seen, you know, you get the pretty good average, but you're like, oh, the voltage really dropped down. Instead of something near 5, I have 488. Well, look, this one is 5.2 with nothing plugged into it. When I plug something into it, it drops to 498, which seems more acceptable. You know, it's just really educational. And they're not expensive. Again, Klein makes 2 versions that I have. One has a load in it, one does not. There's a bunch of other just random brand names that I don't recognize that I've bought their devices and played with them. Really neat stuff. I could take some pictures and send them off to EC2GS or someone like that if you guys are really curious about what I have here and what I've been doing. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Comment.
Okay, so this device you're talking about, John, is it called USB Analyzer? Klein is one of the brand names. Did you buy it on the internet? Roughly how many dollars? Back to you, John.
$20 or $30 will get you something pretty decent. I don't remember the Klein with the load in it. That might have been a little more, maybe something like 40. But I'm going by memory here. I don't have a precise answer for you.
Bravo Zulu, go ahead, Rich number 2.
Just skimming this the site Nuts and Bolts, and there's a fascinating article, which is everything that you talk about, Dick, but with pictures. It's called The Discovery of Radio Waves, and it doesn't say which edition it's in, but it's everything that you mentioned, only illustrated. I just wanted to mention that. So, and I don't want to get Roy angry, so I'm not going to say another word. Whiskey 2. Just kidding. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
So what I think you're saying, Rich, is that the Nuts and Bolts website's got a lot of good data. Nuts and Bolts, I think, is a West Coast weekly magazine. Is that, or is it a monthly? Which is it, Bravo Zulu?
Oh, I'm looking at it with new eyes. I used to read it years back, but I don't know how many years, 10 years or whatever. I've lost track of time, keeping time. But this discovery of radio waves particularly jumped out at me. And for someone who knew visual references like myself, this has it all. It's really beautiful. Just wanted to mention that. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Bi-monthly magazine, Dick.
Bi-monthly. Does that mean it comes out twice a month or every other month? What's the difference between bi-monthly and semi-monthly? Go ahead, Rich. I mean, Roy, I think it is. Okay, it's time to go over to Roy, to the science talk. And Roy has got a good puzzle for us tonight also. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. I'm really looking forward to try out this 3-minute timeout. What am I going to do with all that free time? Just to tie up a little loose ends, all you have to do is look up a USB meter. There's about 100 of them on Amazon, and they even sell one with knobs that have adjustable loads for only $28. So, you know, how can you go wrong? I have about 2 or 3 of those things, you know, scattered around the house. It can be very useful. Anyway, as always, if you have any questions, any topics, any puzzles, any refutations, what have you, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs. Again, mailbag@ac2gs. Everything that I talk about will have links available on my webpage. In addition, Paul has a link that he's going to discuss, and that's on roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, there's a chat room around. If anyone cares to play with it, you can get to it with chat.ac2gs.com. So those are the three things to remember. I will drop for a second, and then we'll move on to the first story. Okay, a few weeks ago I was talking about the United States government's issues with regularly timely corrections of the true magnetic north, and we had a discussion about magnetic fields and cases and protects our Earth. I've done a little bit more reading on the subject, and it seems even stranger than I thought it was. For one, most of this stuff isn't a sure thing, by the way. At this time, they're best theories. They're educated guesses, if you will. The cause for our planetary magnetic field is believed to be a consequence of our core being made up of a spinning solid iron surrounded by a rotating molten layer of liquid iron. The field that covers this is called magnetohydrodynamics. That's how the flow of liquid conductors interacts with magnetic fields, and it's a very complicated thing. It's a mashup of fluid dynamics, which is complicated, and Maxwell's theory, which I'm sure if you've ever seen it, is complicated. Anyway, as I mentioned earlier, the true magnetic North Pole is always changing. You would think that this is a symmetrical thing. I would. Such that the magnetic north pole shifts and the magnetic south pole does exactly the same thing. Well, the magnetic south pole does wander, but surprisingly not as much as the magnetic north pole. And often they're not totally symmetrical. They're not pointing exactly away from each other. When it comes to our planet's magnetic field, facts appear to be stranger than we would assume. Now, I would guess everyone listening to me right now has used a magnetic compass in their lives. It's a relatively simple device, a small magnetized wire hung on a rotating shaft. It's simple, but clever. Once the needle was magnetized, it would rotate and align itself with Earth's magnetic field and offer travelers a simple means to tell north from south. It was used for navigation for over 2,000 years by the Chinese, and it finally arrived in Europe about 1,000 years ago. It's a simple but effective tool. So, my puzzler for tonight is, if you're standing right over the true north magnetic north pole or the magnetic south pole, your compass will no doubt not be terribly helpful. But, do compasses work everywhere else on the surface of the world? Are there places on our Earth where compasses appear to be just broken and useless? So that's the question. What do you think, guys?
AC2, SHO.
Yes, John.
No, the answer is there are places that it will not work. Magnetite, I believe, is the name of, is it a mineral, I guess? But magnetite, if you're in an area where there's a heavy concentration of magnetite, or maybe it doesn't even take a lot, I don't know. Definitely would be a problem because that is magnetized during its creation. You'll probably tell me more about it. I've only read some very basic things. Geology is a big subject out here, you know, in the volcanic region of the United States. So I did see some little articles and, you know, tidbits about magnetite. KC2GS, KC2SHO.
Okay, John, that's a great answer. Does anyone else have any answer to my puzzler tonight?
Sure.
I think that was Rich.
Whatever you believe the cause is in the area called the Bermuda Triangle, it has been proven that compasses often fail in that region, WB2GXM.
Okay, so we have the Bermuda Triangle. Although if you've ever seen reports of the quote Bermuda Triangle, it's really a very deformed polygon. It's nowhere near as nice and clean and neat as a triangle. But okay, so we have one vote for the Bermuda Triangle and a generalized vote that there are places all over the world where your magnetic compass is worthless.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm going with the South Atlantic Anomaly. That's an area where the Van Allen belt is relatively low to the Earth at that location. And I know satellites, and they like to avoid that area. But I understand it interacts with the magnetic field. It might throw it off. I don't know if it, maybe we just weaken it, but I'm going to go with that area. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, that's a very, very good answer. It's going to be one of the right answers, but it's a little bit more complicated, like most things in the universe. Anyone else with any comments? I mean, obviously, if I brought up the subject, it wouldn't be a great puzzler if the answer was no, there's no place that your compass is broken. So ultimately, it turns out to be a question of where in the world do you think your compass would be broken? And one of the places is the South Atlantic Anomaly, which is why they call it the South Atlantic Anomaly. But are there other places?
KTJHR?
Yes. Yes, JHR.
In my reading, there have been a number of places that I've read. The Sea of Japan has an area where you have difficulty with compasses. Of course, as in the Bermuda Triangle, the Gobi Desert. It seems that there are along certain fine meridians that once you have you're on various parts of the Earth, you do have difficulty with compasses, and this is something that's been noted for many, many years. I believe from what I've read there are about 10, but I may be incorrect. Back to you, K2JHR.
Well, thank you very much, and what you're mentioning off of Japan is called the Temagami Magnetic Anomaly, and yes, that's one of them, too. Anyone else with any comments? Okay, although they're very few and far between. There are places on this world where compasses are completely useless gadgets. Now, one of the most famous ones that wasn't brought up tonight is called the Bangui Magnetic Anomaly. It's centered in Bangui, the capital of Central African Republic. It covers an area of approximately 430 by 620 miles. It covers most of that country, making it one of the largest and most intense crustal magnetic anomalies on the African continent. There are others. There's the Kursk Magnetic Anomaly, the South Atlantic Anomaly that Paul mentioned, and the Temagami Magnetic Anomaly that K2JHR indicated. So it's interesting that although compasses are simple and reasonably dependable, there are places like in Central Africa where you just can't use them for anything except maybe either a paperweight or something to protect your drink on a table. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
My question is, well, what do compasses do in this area? Do they point to this region, or is there some combination of forces? They point to some intermediate point? What is it that compasses will do in this area? Go ahead.
Well, it depends upon the location within these anomalies. At some points it deflects it. In one way or another, not in a consistent manner particularly. So if you move off to the left of it, it moves to the right. If you move to the right, it moves to the left. It's kind of like sticking an enormous bar magnet in the middle of a room and trying to figure out what the compass is telling you, if anything. So it just kind of scatters the fields, the magnetic fields locally because of crustal phenomena. Again, a lot of this is highly theoretical. They don't really know exactly why this is happening, whether it's magnetite or something else, but there's a disruption in the crust that produces a closeness of a ferromagnetic material near the surface of the crust and distorts the local planetary magnetic field.
There is a type of compass that I've heard described. It's oriented vertically. I think it's called a declination compass. If you fly over one of these regions, will you get like a dip in this declination compass indicating that there's maybe a big deposit of magnetite there or something else like that? In other words, will you get... Like in the movie 2001 where they saw the Tycho magnetic anomaly, when you get something similar to that indicating that there is a heavy deposit there. Go ahead.
Well, very possibly. I would assume it has a lot to do with the magnetic orientation of the crust material. If it's aligned top to bottom, you'll definitely get something. If it's lined right to left, you may not get much of anything. You know, those would be very good if you were near the magnetic north pole or the magnetic south pole. Then the damn thing would just dip all the way down. But again, you might pick up some parts and not other parts of these anomalies because they're not in a very orderly orientation as far as I'm aware.
I see. Okay, thank you.
T2JHR, I just have a general question to ask you specific to the topic.
Yeah, sure, JHR. Ask away.
Okay, just so that you know, we're on Echo Link. We're in Atlanta, Georgia right now. I had read for a number of years that the areas of the Black Sea, of course the South Atlantic, and also the coast off the coast of Japan, that there have been changes within, as you said, the Earth's crust in those particular areas where you have these magnetic anomalies. And there seems to be, for some reason, you have more or less like underground or undersea earthquakes, and ships have been pulled down, aircraft. Sometimes you get water spouts where they're affecting aircraft. And I'm just wondering, how do you recall or how do you relate to the fact that you get such type of material changes within the Earth's crust only in those specific areas, and how does that relate to these magnetic values?
Well, I would assume it's part of the wonderful world of plate tectonics, because most of the surface of the Earth is underwater, most of the plates are underwater, and they're scraping underneath and pulling up stuff from deep below the crust. And so my guess is that the more active plate tectonic activity that we're not as incredibly aware of. You know, when it happens in the San Andreas Fault, a lot of real estate gets messed up. But if it happens in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, it might give you a tsunami or something. But other than that, it's kind of hidden from us. So I'm assuming that a lot of this is caused by plate tectonics of getting down into the crust material that contains things like magnetite and other ferromagnetic minerals there.
I appreciate it. I thank you, because I've looked into that for years myself, assuming similar, but I'm glad to get it, as they say, from the horse's mouth. All right, again, I thank you. This is K2JHR just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. My name is Joel, J-O-E-L, also from New York City, but right now working in this area. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Joel. Yeah, I'm watching you on Echolink, so I knew to kind of just let it pause, because Echolink has a long delay time with picking up the signal. So keep listening. We have one guy in Australia who frequents us. I don't see that he's here today, but he's a regular listener. So welcome to aboard.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I've also have been a long time Line Mark member. Fortunately, out of the area at this time. At 7-3s, we'll be listening on site, K2JHR.
Hey, very good. On to the next. Man has feared automation for centuries now, but gone are the simpler days when machines relieved us of boring, repetitive tasks. This next generation of machines will do the thinking for us as well. AI, artificial intelligence, while science is getting its problems ironed out, it can do a lot of intelligent things, some non-intelligent things, but it's getting a lot better over time. Algorithms have screwed up in horrifying, hilarious, and unfortunate ways that we've talked about in the past. So it's nice when one has the potential to save lives, nearly nailed it. On this past Monday, Google AI researchers, along with healthcare researchers, published research showing that they successfully trained a deep learning algorithm to detect lung cancer with a 94.4% success rate. Findings were published in the journal Nature Medicine this past Monday, which indicates that aside from just a high accuracy rate, the algorithm outclassed radiologists under certain circumstances. According to the study, the system achieved that success rate on 6,716 cases from the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial, with a similar accuracy of 1,139 independent clinical cases. The researchers conducted two studies, one in which a prior scan was available and one in which it wasn't. In the former scenario, the deep learning algorithm, which was trained on computed tomography scans of people with lung cancer and without it and with nodules, turned cancerous. The New York Times reported it had a higher identification rate than six radiologists, and in the latter, the humans and the machines were even. The whole experimentation process is like a student in school, said Dr. Daniel Tsai, a project manager at Google, who talked to the New York Times. We're using large data sets for training, giving it lessons and pop quizzes so it can begin to learn for itself what is cancer and what will or will not be cancer in the future. We gave it a final exam on the data that it's never seen before. We spent a lot of time training it, and the results we saw on the final exam was that it got an A, and it got percent. But the results of this study are very much baby first steps version of the algorithm identification. It's still far from having proven itself as accurate enough to be deployed pervasively across healthcare institutions providing cancer screening. It does signal some promise when it comes to automating a process that struggles with false positives and negatives. A lot of tech companies, like Google, are already leaning on algorithms as a tool for detection on platforms in a way that's large-scale, mostly for moderation. These automated systems are still deeply flawed, leading to mistaken censorship, or worse, a failure to identify violent and hateful content running rampant. But the researchers working on the lung cancer detection technology acknowledge the dangers and risks of unleashing such a system without first comprehensively confirming that it's effective, and also ensuring that there are checks and balances in places to continuously regulate it and protect it from bad actors. Quote, we are collaborating with institutions around the world to get a sense of how the technology can be implemented into clinical practice in a productive way, Dr. Say told the New York Times. said, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. So the bottom line of that particular story is don't go into radiology, because you're going to be replaced by a computer. Who knows who's next to be replaced by a computer. Anyway, I'll drop for a sec and then on to the next story. Okay, we've talked a lot about Japan's Hayabusa 2 probe, and it's apparently in the news once again. The probe aborted an attempt to drop a highly reflective target marker on the surface of Ryugu in preparation for its second sample extraction mission. But with surface temperatures rising steadily on the asteroid, the probe is running out of its time. The Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency is in the midst of contemplating a second touchdown mission for Hayabusa 2 to collect surface materials. The probe managed to scoop up samples this past February, so the space agency isn't under a huge amount of pressure to make a second attempt, given all the risks. That said, the second touchdown would be icing on the cake, and is already a very delicious cake. So, back in April, Hayabusa 2 created an artificial crater by shooting a projectile into the asteroid's surface. The tiny blast kicked up material from deeper within Ryugu, which JAXA is now hoping to collect for analysis. The next step is for the probe to drop a reflective target marker in the area near the crater to assist with navigation. This operation, dubbed CPT-TM1, was scheduled for May 14th to 16th, but the mission was unsuccessful. Hayabusa 2 failed to drop the marker, returning to its home position some 12.4 miles above the asteroid. This news isn't great, given that Ryugu will reach its closest orbital position to the sun in a few weeks, the time when surface temperatures will be way too hot for Hayabusa 2 to make a touchdown. Before the operation, JAXA had designated three candidate areas for the surface from which Hayabusa could collect surface materials. A total of 11 candidate points were chosen, as shown, the spots were designated at 01, C01, and L14, and the debris crater was settled for. The PPT-TM1 operation, JAXA had instructed Hayabusa to drop the target marker onto location S01. On May 14th, the probe began to descend towards the asteroid at a speed of 1.3 feet per second. As it got closer, the probe slowed down to 0.3 feet per second, and JAXA had targeted an altitude of 115 feet for the probe to drop its marker, but it never got that close. Let me drop for a sec. The spacecraft descent has been autonomously aborted at an altitude of about 164 feet, JAXA announced in a tweet. Hayabusa 2 is currently rising to its home position. Telemetry from the spacecraft has been confirmed, and the spacecraft is normal, but the target marker has not been dropped, end quote. A subsequent tweet stated that JAXA will investigate to determine the cause of the aborted operation. That said, a similar thing happened back in September 2018. During this early phase of the mission, Hayabusa 2's radar system had difficulty receiving signals from the surface owing to the asteroid's low reflectivity. JAXA found a fix for that problem at the time, so hopefully it'll manage to do it again in this case. But as JAXA hasn't yet decided to go ahead with the second touchdown attempt, the space agency has to decide if the risks are worth it. The probe could smash into the asteroid or be damaged by debris during extraction attempts. Indeed, it would be tragic if something catastrophic happened to Hayabusa 2, given that it's already managed to collect surface materials. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Did they mention why they need the target, that marker, and what is the marker? You know, is it a piece of metal or is it something that the, I don't think Hayabusa has laser, so they have radar, but the radar would work on the asteroid itself. What's the deal with the marker? They say, what the heck do they need that for?
Well, the way they seem to describe it is that they're going to, they wanted to use it to check their coordinates, and they don't really mention the nature of it other than it being reflective. So it could be ceramic, it could be metallic. It has probably a metallic layer to it, because that's probably the best reflective material. But this, apparently their plan for the mission entailed a triangulation of a landmark that was artificial. They didn't really go into details, at least from the article that I've read.
Oh, okay. Well, if it's reflective, that might be for the scientists. They might want to know where exactly on this asteroid they got the material from, and they might be able to put two and two together, you know, back in the lab when they ever get the stuff back. This is the one that I know. This is the one that's supposed to land in Australia, I think. I think this one goes to Australia. I'm not sure. It'll come down on a parachute, you know, a heat shield type of a parachute. I'm trying to remember if it's Sea of Japan or Australia. I think this one goes to Australia. Did they say where the thing is eventually going to wind up?
This particular article didn't go into that, but I remember from previous stories about Hayabusa, too, I might be wrong, I believe that it goes down in Australia. Apparently, the Australians have a deal with them about their space program, and, of course, Australia has a large, large desert area that's not populated with anything, so... it's a wet landing versus a dry landing. So my understanding is that it's coming down in Australia.
Yeah, that makes sense. They don't want to lose this in the water. That's good. Scientists will love all this. Yeah, that's probably why they need a marker then. Okay, Roy. Very good.
Okay, very good. On to the next. Life is priceless, right? Well, certainly not to the average health insurance provider. The price recently set by the Swiss drug maker Novartis may be the world's highest for a single treatment, prompting a renewed debate about how society will pay for this new gene therapy breakthrough. The Food and Drug Administration this past Friday approved a gene therapy for spinal muscular atrophy, a rare muscle-wasting disease that in its most severe form kills many babies before they turn 2 years of age. The price will be $2.1 million, believed to be the highest ever set for a one-time treatment. The therapy, to be sold as Zolgensma, alters the underlying genetic cause of spinal muscular atrophy and may permanently stop the disease. It's among the first of a host of gene therapies that promise a cure for deadly inherited conditions. Quote, we feel we're on the path where we hope one day to be able to bring spinal muscular atrophy almost to elimination, end quote, said Vas Narasimhan, the Novartis chief executive, in a conference call with reporters. Many drugs for rare diseases have arrived on the market recently, costing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. But few have crossed the $1 million threshold. Luxturna, a gene therapy that treats a rare inherited form of blindness, costs $850,000. And Timria, Novartis's one-time cell therapy treatment for leukemia, costs $475,000. The annual cost of some of the other rare disease drugs can top $1 million, depending upon a patient's weight. Let me drop for a sec. In addition to the staggering price, Novartis also unveiled a plan this past Friday that would allow insurers to pay for the treatment over a five-year period, which would average out to be $425,000 a year, which the company notes is comparable to the prices of other treatments of ultra-rare disorders. Novartis had declined until now to reveal Zolgensma's price, but its executives have been on a month-long publicity tour making the case for a multi-million dollar price tag. At an event this past week in Boston, for example, Mr. Narishan told reporters that Novartis plans to set a price that is far lower than the $4 to $5 million the company had determined that the treatment was worth, according to Reuters. Critics say the statements were part of a sophisticated effort to acclimate the public to an astronomical price. The industry is masterful at creating certain facts, which become immutable even though they're not, said Dr. Peter B. Bach, the director of the Center of Health Policy and Outcomes at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Quote, they have been whispering the price of multiple millions of dollars now for years so that the marketplace at some level now believes this is how much these things will cost. In an interview before the approval, David Lennon, the president of AveXis, the Novartis unit developing Zolgensma, said the company set the price based on a 50% discount off of what Novartis believes it is worth, measured in part by the long-term cost of other rare disease drugs. Spinraza, a drug approved in 2016 that also treats spinal muscular atrophy, cost $750,000 in the first year of treatment, and then about $375,000 a year after that. The cost of a decade of treatment with Spinraza, therefore, is more than $4 million. Let me drop for a second. Quote, we believe this is a balanced approach, end quote, Mr. Lennon said in the interview. Quote, we do have high hopes that this is an extremely durable product and really does have the potential to provide a lifetime of benefit, end quote. Spinal muscular atrophy affects the motor nerve cells in the spinal cord, causing the body to lose physical strength and eventually robbing people of their ability to walk, talk, swallow, and breathe. About 1 in 11,000 babies are born with spinal muscular atrophy. Before Spinraza's approval, there was no treatment at all. The children with type 1 often died before they turned 2. The Food and Drug Administration approved the treatment for under 2 with all forms of spinal muscular atrophy. Novartis said that there are about 400 new patients a year, or about 30 a month. In addition, 700 patients who already have the disease are eligible for the treatment. Tina and Torrance Anderson's baby, Malachi, was diagnosed with spinal muscular atrophy in November 2015 when he was nearly 4 months old. The doctor who gave the Andersons the news didn't have much to offer. Quote, she told us, you have 6 to 12 months, said Ms. Anderson of Mansfield, Ohio. Take him home and love him. There's not much you can do, end quote. But after some online research, the Andersons enrolled Malachi in the clinical trial for Zoliqna, and he received the treatment in December. Malachi is now almost 4 years old, a cheerful, active boy who can push the wheels on his wheelchair, feeds himself, and loves to watch shows like Paw Patrol and PJ Masks. Basically, he's like a normal toddler. He just can't stand or walk. Ms. Anderson said Novartis arranged the interview with the Anderson. Let me drop for a sec. The clinical trials of Zolgensma, on which the approval was based, involved just 36 people, but Novartis said that it has treated almost about 150 patients as officials made the treatment available on an emergency basis. So far, the results do not show that the effects of the treatment have waned. Mr. Lennon said, quote, we have kids approaching their fifth birthday now, looking to go to kindergarten next year, which is a fantastic thing, he said. Ms. Anderson said many parents with children who have spinal muscular atrophy are excited about the arrival of Zolgensma, but anxious about how it will be paid for. Some worry that if their children are already taking Spinraza, insurance companies won't approve the treatment with Zolgensma. To me, it's worth saving my child, Ms. Anderson said. I'd give up everything, my house, my car, everything. Nothing could put a cost on saving my child's life. But at $2.1 million of treatment, Zolgensma would be out of the reach for most American families without the approval of insurance companies. In addition to the payment plan, Novartis also said it would provide a discount. Now, how much has not been decided. If a patient who takes Zolgensma dies or eventually needs permanent ventilator support. Let me drop for a sec. In exchange, Novartis is asking insurers to promise that they will cover the treatment and that they will quickly decide if a child qualifies. Quote, we know that treating these kids quickly is really paramount, end quote, Mr. Lennon said. The payment plans will be administered through Accredo, the specialty pharmacy unit of Express Scripts, which is now owned by Cigna. Dr. Steve Miller, the chief clinical officer of Cigna, said Accredo would collect payments for administering arrangements with insurers, but declined to say how much, saying that each case would be different. Catherine Donaldson, a spokeswoman for the American Health Insurance Plans, a trade group for insurers, said that while some arrangements, such as money-back guarantees, can be useful, they won't solve the underlying problem, which is the high prices that drug makers set. And while treatments like Zolgensma are promising, she said in a statement, quote, the data collected on gene therapies is still relatively in its infancy, and they do not have the long-term evidence to confirm they are a lifetime cure, end quote. Because of the life-saving nature of the treatment and because of the disease being so rare, many insurers are likely to cover Zolgensma. But some experts worry about the cumulative impact should other drug makers follow Novartis's lead. More than 60 gene therapies are expected on the market by 2024, according to Evaluate Pharma. Quote, the drugs coming to the market are going to be things that we will not want to walk away from, end quote, said Dr. Stephen D. Pearson, the president of the Institute of Clinical and Economic Review, an independent watchdog group. The group said that at $2.1 million, the new drug could be considered cost-effective in part because it can be used on babies who have not yet shown symptoms of the disease. Still, Dr. Pearson said in an interview before approval, the real question is, who's going to pay for this? Who indeed? Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WV2U with a question.
Yes, V2U.
Is there any realistic justification for such a high price? I mean, is it a labor-intensive or a custom drug, or is this just profiteering by the drug company?
It depends on who you talk to, whether you talk to the drug companies or anyone but the drug companies or anyone who took any courses in economics. What it appears to be is they are not factoring in the cost, at least not from this article. They are factoring in what the value of this vague value of something that never existed before, and they're calming everyone by saying we're only charging half of that. So I don't even think they're mentioning the research development and the cost of producing this stuff. They just kind of came up with this idea that we're going to cure little harmless children are dying. We have a magic pill that will stop them from dying. We figure it's worth $5 million. We'll give it to you for $2.5 million.
WVTU, that's really absolutely horrible. I mean, you know, I could understand it if it was like a custom-made drug that, you know, took a lot of expensive labor to produce, that would make sense to me, but this seems like straight profiteering, so I guess I'm starting to lean more towards the politicians who want to, quote, control drug prices, because it seems like an abuse more than anything else.
I might have a jaundiced view of it, but I have noticed the pharmaceutical companies have become more and more avaricious in the decades of practicing medicine. There were medicines that became generic and the price dropped, and then companies that make non-generics would tend to buy the generic drug companies and raise up the price. I've seen things that used to cost $25 now going for something like $110, $120, and everyone who's read a newspaper knows about the epinephrine pens and how they increase dramatically for no apparent reason. There's nothing that terribly magic about epinephrine. It's not that difficult to manufacture. So I think, unfortunately, it's time for trust busters and people to get involved and look into where these strange numbers come from. The problem with medicine is you're not going directly to the customer. You're going to an intermediary who will just pass on the cost. And also, life is priceless. But the reality, unfortunately, is life is not priceless because someone's got to pay for it.
Hey, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
Last week's 60 Minutes had a segment exactly on the generic drug price rise. And it's all about collusion, you know. Nothing new there, but there'll probably be some Senate, some congressional investigation into it. But they are colluding so heavily that they would email each other, saying that they're gonna raise the price of the drug tomorrow, or you win. And the other competing company would say, we're in. I mean, it's that blatant. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I'm getting to the point where we really need to find or clone Teddy Roosevelt. We need a trust buster. Business is great, but sometimes if you leave them alone too long, they think a little bit too much, and they stop competing with each other, and they start agreeing and forming trusts and milking the rest of us. So I can't begin to guess what's going to happen, because the trend will be that this is just the tip on the spear. As time goes on, there will hopefully be incredible genetic treatment available. But if each and every one of them is going to go at $2-4 million a clip, it's going to bankrupt the country in about 5 years. So something's got to give. I don't know how much it costs to research, development, and manufacture. And it's not like these guys are going to give anyone the right answer, but something's got to give. Unfortunately, I think to a degree there are going to be some cures that just won't be available at a certain point, because it would bankrupt the country to pay them. And almost no one other than the 1% have the money to spend for it. So it's going to be like some really bad dystopian science fiction, where the rich kind of live nice lives and the rest of us fend for ourselves.
You say designer drugs are 20 years away from the general republic, the general public.
Well, the great line is to just say 10 years in the future, because everything is 10 years in the future. Fusion, generation of power is always 10 years. It's been 10 years in the future for the last 50 years. So I will continue to define tradition and say that the designer genetic drugs will at least be in the experimental testing phase in 10 years. How's that?
Very generic answer. You're colluding with Dick? Just kidding. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
If I had a crystal ball, it would be great for the stock market and not to mention the lottery.
It's just shocking to have generic drug companies colluding together. And they're not yelling, no colluding, no whatever else Trump is saying. No cover-up, no collusion. Well, this is a cover-up and a collusion. But generic drugs were supposed to be the great savior of the common man. And for them to be in bed together raising prices is just beyond capitalism imagination.
Greed is a universal human weakness. We're all given to it to one degree or another, but these guys, and sometimes it's not just loose collusion. Sometimes major pharmaceutical companies will buy up generic pharmaceutical companies and basically, tell them what to do. So it's very sad. I remember when the generic medications were much less expensive. The quantity and the quality hasn't changed at all. There's really no decent explanation for it. If you get most people, executives there, they kind of shrug, and they're saying that, well, intermediaries in healthcare drive the prices of things up, but they can't show any paperwork that actually shows that. So, you know, epinephrine pen really upset a lot of people because there's a lot of people with allergies who carry them around just in case, you know, someone sneaks them a peanut and they go into anaphylactic shock and they grab for their epinephrine pen. Those prices skyrocketed. They didn't have a good reason. It's great. This makes the go-go years of the 1980s seem like a Good Samaritan. Anyway, on to the next story. A team of physicists have published a peer-reviewed result document of near room temperature superconductivity in a hydrogen-rich compound called lanthanum hydride. Researchers around the world are racing to produce a material that at room temperature conducts electricity without losing energy to resistance. Most recently, scientists have focused their attention on a substance called lanthanum hydride, which is compressed between diamonds to pressures similar to those found in the Earth's core. The new paper sets the temperature to beat at minus 23 degrees Celsius. That's minus 9.67 degrees Fahrenheit. Technically, you could say it's room temperature if you were in the middle of a polar vortex condition in the Midwest. Anyway, physicist Heike Kamerling Onnes discovered superconductivity in 1911 in the element mercury, held at nearly absolute zero. Since then, scientists have worked to increase the temperature at which materials turn into superconductors, since these materials could transfer electricity more cheaply and have important uses in the medical and quantum computing fields. The search now includes the field of physicists attempting to reveal new properties of hydrogen or molecules containing mostly hydrogen called hydride, squeezed between diamonds to high pressures. The team, led by physicist Mikhail Eremets of the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry, kicked off the most recent race for a high-temperature superconducting hydride in 2015. When he published a paper announcing the discovery of superconductivity at minus 70 degrees Celsius, that's minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit, by the way. In this most recent paper, the researchers placed a piece of lanthanum into an insulating ring, then placed it in a box full of pressurized hydrogen gas. They clamped the gasket between a pair of diamonds and continued squeezing the diamond until they hit the desired pressure, which was nearly 2 million times the pressure on the surface of the Earth. Then they hit the sample with a laser to form the lanthanum hydride. Finally, they took measurements to confirm that it was really creating the material and that it's really a superconductor. Let me drop for a sec. The researchers detailed two measurements in the paper. In one, they measured the resistance drop to zero at the minus 23 degrees Celsius temperature. In another, they noticed that this temperature decreased in the presence of a magnetic field. That's a clue that they were actually measuring the sample rather than something being wrong with their experimental setup. This paper first came out this past December, but now it appears in a peer-reviewed journal, solidifying the results as a number to beat for those hunting for high-temperature superconductors. These papers are milestones for more than just the warm temperature, though. In the past, discovering new superconductors has required luck, since the temperature at which things turn into superconductors are hard to predict. But more recently, discoveries of high-temperature superconductors have been guided by a theory. There is a ton more work to do. Superconductors don't allow magnetic fields to pass through them, a phenomenon called the Meissner effect. Scientists have measured this effect in lanthanum hydride. They haven't measured it in lanthanum hydride yet, but there are other teams around the world working hard to find materials that turn into superconductors at even higher temperatures or lower pressures, which would make them more practical to use in modern technology. So as of today, though it seems that scientists have a pretty firm foundation to build upon, a lot more research is needed. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX. Okay, on to the next. The recovery of the ozone hole has been a quintessential environmental success story, as the world has worked largely in harmony with in decades to phase out ozone-depleting chemicals. So last year's discovery that emissions of CFC-11, one of those banned chemicals, was suddenly reversing course came as a shock. Now scientists have pinpointed the primary source of the rogue emissions. The findings published in Nature this past Thursday show that eastern China is responsible for upwards of 60% of the recent rise in CFC-11 emissions. The results pushed Chinese authorities to find out the exact source and stop the emissions before they deal a major setback to ozone hole recovery. The world has been on track to clean up the ozone hole problem by 2060, thanks in part to cooperation under the protocol. That international treaty went into effect in 1989 with nations agreeing to reduce ozone-depleting chemicals, many of which are involved in industrial complex processes. CFC-11 is one of those chemicals which is used in refrigeration and the production of foams, and emissions of the chemical have been declining for decades thanks to the phase-out efforts to gather up any remaining materials made with it and bank them for destruction. But in 2012, the decline in emissions started to slow, meaning that there was a rogue source producing chemicals, or at least emitting them. The study last year used data from a remote clean environment in Hawaii. Matt Rigby, the new study's lead author and University of Bristol atmospheric scientist, told the press that allows you to work out the global changes in emissions. Let me drop for a sec. Rigby and other scientists working on the issue had a hunch China might be the source of rogue emissions, but they couldn't tease that out from the Hawaii data set alone. So they turned to air monitoring stations in Japan and Korea for the new study and weathering modeling. The findings show that China's CFC-11 emissions went from an average of 6.4 gigagrams per year from 2008 to 2012, all the way up to 13.4 gigagrams a year between 2014 and 2017. The weather modeling helps further pinpoint the results to show that Northeast China is the source of the emission, though the method doesn't allow for pinpointing specific factories as the guilty parties. The country has said it plans to crack down on the source of emissions as part of its commitment to the Montreal Protocol. And the findings provide a clearer roadmap for where it can look for the excess emissions. Quote, the new analysis narrows the options on sources and locations, providing stronger evidence that the emissions are from new production and from eastern China. This should put more pressure on China to investigate and curtail any rogue production, end quote. The results also point to the value of air quality monitoring. Without the local measurements, we would never know Northeast China was the source of the CFC-11 emissions. Quote, we can only really see a few hundred kilometers from measurement stations, Rigby said. With the infrastructure we've got, we can do this analysis on North America, parts of Europe, and a small part of Eastern Asia. There are clearly other sources of rogue emissions, and increasing the network of monitoring stations will be a way to keep on top of these emissions now and in the future to ensure CFC-11 continues to be phased out. Doing so will offer a number of benefits. The first is the ozone hole. Rigby said that the new emissions themselves are modest, but if they continue at current levels, we're potentially looking at delays or years of, or decades of delays for the ozone hole to shrink back to the 1980s level. CFC-11 is also a potential greenhouse gas that has roughly 5,000 times the warming potential of carbon dioxide. Rigby said the uptick in northeastern Chinese emissions have the same impact on the climate as all the London carbon-based emissions. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
They don't have an ocean. They don't have anything like we have, or a lot of countries have. You know, there's no safety involved. They have a space program that's, you know, they think nothing of just letting the boosters fall into, they think rural areas, but they've actually hit buildings and people, and they land on roads. they try to cover it up, they just make, you know, say, oh, no, that nobody got killed. And, you know, there's no way to prove it. So if they're doing that so openly, I'm sure they're probably letting CFC 11 out as well. I believe that used to also be used as a cleaning fluid, fluorine 11.